At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Today I'm joined by Vicky Vella. Vicky is a retired associate specialist in emergency medicine and has worked in A&E for 30 years. Vicky is passionate about teaching healthcare professionals about eating disorders and so joins us today to discuss their experience of eating disorders in A&E and their involvement in the new eating disorder guidance, MEED, which stands for Medical Emergencies in Eating Disorders. Hello, Vicky.
Hello, hi. Thank you for having me on.
No, thank you for joining me. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you, on this lovely sunny day.
Good, good. I know, I just went outside. I have been stuck working inside all day and I just went outside. It's like, wow, it's actually so hot. I'm like here in my jogging bottoms and a jumper and it's so warm outside.
Yeah, very hot today. Lovely.
Yeah, it is. I might have to go outside once we've done this and actually get some fresh air. So thank you so much for joining me. I'm really excited to speak to you. I think with your experience and also, you know, the MEED guidelines is quite a relevant thing at the moment with it only just having come out. So I wondered if you wanted to start to kind of speak about where your passion for teaching doctors about anorexia and other eating disorders came from.
Okay, so I was, I have to be quite honest and say I knew very little about anorexia and eating disorders. I didn't really think it was, it's not that I actively didn't think it was an A&E thing. It's not something that ever just crossed my mind as something I needed to know about. Probably because I hadn't really had much teaching about it. It's hard to think back as far as medical school, but I don't think I had a lot of teaching about it at medical school, and certainly as a postgraduate, none at all. And then one of my daughters developed anorexia, and I think because I didn't know that much about it, and probably as a reflection of the fact that I didn't know that much about it, I probably didn't act on it as quickly as I should, because to be honest, once we were in it, I had no idea that it was such a, you know, terrible illness to have. So she became ill, and of course, as parents and in particular doctors tend to do, you try and research the illness as much as you possibly can to find out all about it. I think the doctors have very, very good at doing that, but I think probably most parents of those with eating disorders have to do that anyway, because they get so little information given from them. Well, certainly back then, we're talking about 2015, get so little information from the eating disorder professionals that you've got no choice really but to find out as much about it as you can. Just to know how to deal with it and try and understand it. So because of my experience, I sort of reckoned that if I didn't know very much about it, then probably there were a whole load of other doctors that had never really been taught about it and didn't know very much about it. And so I asked if I could do a talk, just a short talk. It was supposed to be 20 minutes, but it actually grew into about 50 minutes. On a GP paediatric study day that they were doing at the hospital, and they said, yeah, you can do it. And I did my bit and had so much feedback afterwards, people emailing me, people coming up to me afterwards, people crying in the audience at the end of it. that I thought, actually, this is the right thing to be doing. You know, I'm teaching all these GPs and GP trainees that were there today have all learned something they possibly didn't know or hadn't realised that it was all quite as bad as it was. And that spurred me on then. So I slowly started doing more and more. And now I do an awful lot of teaching about it. Mm. And I'm from that teaching, I'm very well aware that most doctors who aren't eating disorder specialists have very little knowledge of it, of eating disorders.
Yeah.
So I carry on.
Which is fantastic that you do. So is the training that you do, is that for GPs, sorry, or is it also for people in like emergency departments?
Oh, I do it for all sorts, to be honest. It started off for those GPs, but now in certainly in Worcestershire, I've done it for the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 years for all the foundation doctors, foundation year ones, foundation year twos, GP trainees, for dietitians. I've done it for dietitians in Worcestershire and also a group of dietitians in a department in Cheshire, I think it was, got in touch with me. So I did one for them. I've done them for paediatricians. I've done them for physicians. Anybody I can grab that I think will come across people with eating disorders, which is actually most doctors in most specialties. Done it for medical, sort of gastroenterology registrars. And my current mission is to get through to obs and gyne doctors. So I've just recorded a video for our local obs and gyne department, the midwives, for them to learn a bit about it. And I'm trying to get some contact with the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists to do something there, because they have nothing on their website at all about eating disorders in pregnancy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that sounds amazing. I think you don't quite realise that anybody in a medical setting could be somebody that could spot an eating disorder. Like, I recently started thinking about dentists and how, you know, especially in bulimia, they could be the ones to acknowledge the change in your teeth. Are there specific things in your training that you say to people, like, these are the signs to look out for? Or does it vary on the profession?
Yes, and actually it's not the signs to look out for. What I try and do more of is tell them about the side of eating disorders that they're not going to get from books, from standard textbooks. So there's no point, I don't think, in me standing up, giving them a load of signs and symptoms of how to spot somebody with an eating disorder, because they can read that in a book. What I try and do is, or what I do, is tell them more about what's going on in the mind of somebody with an eating disorder, and how they're being controlled by the, you know, it's not them being in control, they're being controlled by an eating disorder, and they're not choosing to be like this, and that, because I, you know, it probably isn't a very good thing to say, but I think a lot of medical doctors who don't know much about eating disorders, particularly when people with anorexia are in acute medical beds, find them really challenging. You know, they don't particularly, they're not particularly keen on admitting people, because they think, one, they're going to be there for ages, and they might see them as challenging and a bit manipulative and a bit argumentative and difficult, and can't understand why they're refusing this, that and the other, and just think that they're really difficult. So what I try and do is tell them that it's not actually the person that they're not liking, it's the eating disorder that they're not liking. And inside that really challenging, perhaps slightly difficult patient is actually just a really normal person that just wants help. So those are the lines that I sort of go along in my teaching to try and change attitudes rather than teach them what an eating disorder is. Although I do a bit of that. I do a bit of an introduction on that. And I do go through the sort of risk assessment for the, what was Marzipan, but is now MEAD guidelines, so that they know all the different tests to do before just discharging somebody from an emergency department because they look all right. So going through what the high risk things are that would, you know, make them consider that the person might need admitting for refeeding in an acute hospital bed. So I do go through that, but a lot of what I say is really around just what a terrible illness is and that people aren't choosing it, and that there are just really, really normal people in there trying to get out.
I'm so relieved to hear that. Like, I honestly can't say how relieved, because I did my dissertation for my master's, which was an eating disorders master's, looking at a skills-based workshop for paediatric nurses on an inpatient ward. And that was basically to, you know, design this workshop that, you know, like you're saying, would allow people to learn about eating disorders and stuff like that. And a lot of the research that I read on like paediatric nurses' role in eating disorders said that one of the biggest challenges was that paediatric nurses didn't want to work with people with eating disorders because they were seen as, you know, manipulative, or they weren't grateful for the treatment, or there were so many arguments, and it was a very tiring thing to work with, because a lot of the time, you know, if you think about different mental health conditions, you know, people may, or other like physical health conditions, people will come to the hospital and they want to get better, whereas a lot of the time with people with eating disorders, they don't want to get better at the initial stages, and it's kind of you have to really support somebody to want to get better. So the fact that you're explaining to them, you know, it's not actually the person that you're, you know, have a dyslexia or whatever, it's the eating disorder, I think, yeah, that's just so fundamental. And I think that's something that's massively missed in a lot of training.
I do training for nurses actually at the, because they're key really with the inpatients in the acute hospitals, because they're the ones really that should be ensuring that they're having their feeds on time and, you know, eating their food and having their drinks and all that, not pacing and all that kind of thing. And, so I got in touch with the University of Worcester here, and actually just a few weeks ago I did a 3-hour lecture for their nursing students. But actually what they've done there, which is fantastic, it was the second years of the general nursing, paediatric nursing and RMN nursing students, because it's of relevance to all. And so, you know, that's really good if I can get them, because at least then when they go on the wards, they will have an understanding of it. And I do medical students as well. And as I said, the junior doctors, and I always say to them, you know, that you will now know probably 100% more about eating disorders now than your registrars or consultants will. So please have the courage to challenge them if you feel that they're not sort of having the right attitude towards the patients on the ward, or, you know, I've heard of them being put on end of life pathways and, you know, being talked about within earshot but behind their back about them and all this, and that hopefully they will have the courage to challenge that behaviour by their seniors because they've been taught about it. And that's also why I get the dietitians, because it's interesting how many people like the RMN nurses in Worcester, and I think probably in a lot of places, have no training on eating disorders. And to me, that's quite worrying, because those RMNs will become mental health liaison staff, and they'll see people in A&E who have perhaps overdosed or self-harmed or something like that. And if they don't have an understanding of eating disorders, they're not going to do proper assessments. And also when I just said, oh, and dietitians, is that although at, you know, at university, when they do their degree, they learn all about the nutritional side of it, actually they don't know anything about eating disorders per se. And to me, because they are the constants on the ward, whether it's a medical or paediatric or gastro ward, they're the constants. You know, the junior doctors and, you know, a lot of the nurses will come and go. But they, if they've got a knowledge of it, should impress upon the staff how important it is that, you know, they do get their food at the right time and it's not kind of left for a couple of hours because somebody needs antibiotics and somebody needs something else. Mm. Their food is just as important to have on time as it is for somebody to have antibiotics on time. So the dietitians, I sort of think if they've got an understanding of what's going on, then they can impress upon the staff how important the nutritional side of it is as well. So everybody really needs to know, don't they?
Absolutely.
Everybody's got key roles, haven't they? But I just think the more people know about it, you know, the more chance there is of somebody challenging somebody on the ward who doesn't know about it.
I was just thinking then, as you were kind of talking about with the dietitians of, like, you know, making sure that people get their food on time and stuff. Do you think it's possible for somebody to be treated with an eating disorder on like a general inpatient ward? Or do you think because of the sort of nuances of it, it needs to be an eating disorder ward?
Well, unfortunately, it can't always be an eating disorder unit, can it? Because if somebody's physically unstable, they can't have drips and potassium replacement and things like that done in an eating disorder unit. So, you know, there are certain things that really could only be done under observation on a medical ward. But, you know, in an ideal world, once they've been stabilized and their refeeding was started, then they should be able to go into an eating disorder bed. But I think we all know how short we are of those, which is why, you know, they often get stuck on medical wards for weeks, don't they, or months sometimes, where they try and find a bed for them. But, you know, for as long as they're on a acute medical ward, they're literally only being looked after in the sort of medical sense, if you like, but nothing else is going on. They're literally just being fed, aren't they? So stabilized.
And I guess, you know, that highlights the importance, like you were saying earlier, of everybody knowing about eating disorders. Because I mean, I think sometimes if somebody is in a, you know, a medically unstable condition, the most important thing is to get them into a place where they are medically stable. And often, you know, people can't start the sort of therapeutic work until they're in that medically stable position. But I think it's, you know, critical that people are aware. I remember when I did my dissertation, things like taking a patient to the toilet, or, you know, like you said earlier, pacing and stuff like that, is having that awareness of the compensatory behaviours as well. Because, you know, with a typical patient that might turn up into A&E or to be on an inpatient ward, they might be able to have a few more freedoms. But with somebody with an eating disorder in that medically compromised state, they need to be monitored and supported constantly.
I mean, you wouldn't expect them to get therapeutic sort of treatment on an acute medical ward. You know, you don't expect them to start having psychologists and family therapists and what have you going in there. But they should, in an ideal world, be having the right sort of support whilst they're having their meal or their tube feed or whatever, because they can become really, really distressed while they're having that. So to have somebody talking to them and supporting them in the correct way you know, can make that a lot less difficult for them. And then, of course, making sure that they maybe don't just run to the bathroom straight afterwards and that kind of thing, you know. So there is a need, even if they're not specialists in it, and it's not really a therapeutic thing, but just that knowing how to support them is really important. Yeah,
definitely. Did you have much experience of kind of having people with eating disorders when you worked in A&E yourself, or was it something that, I guess, maybe at the time you weren't that aware of?
Well, once I knew about it, yes, plenty of experience. I mean, I can't remember patients before I became, you know, more knowledgeable on this. I can't remember seeing many patients with it. Certainly not those, I think, kind of got in my mind maybe one or two that were really, really severely ill, who were easy just to admit to the medics. But I'm sort of worried that there might have been quite a few that I missed because I didn't pick up the signs, maybe in people that had self-harmed or, you know, coming suicidal or something. But certainly since knowing what I know now, I saw quite a few. Now, it may be that that's because people at work knew about it. So they say, oh, Vicky, you know, can you go and see, you know, this is one for you to see. So it might be that I was getting more of them and others were getting fewer of them. But also, I think maybe because I was asking the right questions, I was finding more of them, you know, and getting them to tell me about it, whereas I wouldn't have done before. So I really pushed, and I still don't think it is on the sort of checklist, but I really pushed for questions about eating to be on our sort of checklist that we did with any mental health patient. So anybody that came in with, you know, self-harm, overdoses, suicidal thoughts, depression, you know, all of those things. But they said, no, they wouldn't put it on. So probably not everybody was asking, but I always would ask. And I found it amazing, actually, the number of people who might come in having self-harmed and they'll be telling me why and what's happened. And it's not anything at all eating disorder related. And then I might say at the end, oh, and how about your eating? And it's amazing how many would then say, oh, well, yeah, this or that. I don't want to say it out loud, really, because, you know, you don't want to trigger anybody, but you know, oh, actually, I do sometimes vomit after meals, or I sometimes don't eat very much, and it would all come out. And then I'd put a big thing on the notes for the mental health liaison staff, you know, please think about referral to the eating disorder service. So I think I was finding them, whereas you know, 10 years ago I probably wouldn't have done, because I wouldn't have known to ask those questions.
Was it as simple as you asking, you know, how are things with food, or were there other questions that you asked? I'm just thinking if people are listening and maybe advice.
Well, I think I would just start off with a very general, oh, and how's your eating, you know, and with the younger patients, you would usually have a parent or somebody in with them. So, you know, very often they'd all just laugh and say, yes, not a problem at all. And then you wouldn't really have to ask more. But sometimes they might just say something, you know, like, oh, don't even eat very much, or she's very picky with her food or something like that. And then you might just go in a bit more, you know, about whether they've always been like that, whether there's been a change, and, you know, how they feel about food and that kind of thing, just explore a bit more. But, you know, just a very general question to start with. And I think you can tell from the way they answer it if everything's fine and you don't really need to delve anymore.
Yeah. Well, I think that would be really useful advice for people if they are listening, because I think starting that conversation can be quite difficult, especially in, you know, such a high pressure environment. If it's, you know, a simple thing that you can ask, and then if people divulge some more information, I think that will be very, very handy. So thank you. I wanted to ask you some questions about MEAD, the new guidelines. So if people are listening and thinking, well, what on earth is MEAD? Do you mind just kind of giving an explanation?
Yeah, so MEAD is a new incarnation of the marzipan guidelines. So if people really don't know any of this stuff, so the just as a little sort of backstory, so the marzipan guidelines stood for management of the really sick patient with anorexia nervosa. And these were some guidelines that were first written. They first were published in 2010, I think it was. And this was done by a few sort of clinicians who realised that there was a real problem with people with anorexia mainly dying on medical wards, basically through lack of knowledge of staff. Of non-eating disorder specialists. So the guidelines were put together for primarily for non-eating disorder specialists to refer to if they had somebody with anorexia, to guide them, you know, how to assess them, how to refeed them and all that kind of thing. So the first one was in 2010, and then in 2014, junior marzipan came out. So that was for under 18s, and then might have been 2012, and then 2014, there was another incarnation of the adult one. Anyway, so they decided a few years ago that a rewrite was necessary for a variety of reasons. So I was very honoured, I suppose, to be asked to be the emergency medicine representative in the working group and also a carer representative. So we started working on it a few years ago, but then, of course, something happened and everything got pushed back. So everybody's been working really, really hard in the last year to get it out. And it was finally published at the end of May, second last week of May, at an eating disorder faculty conference. So, yeah, that's what MEAD is. So they've changed the name to Managing Emergencies in Eating Disorders. And the name was changed for a couple of reasons. One, because in general, people with eating disorders didn't like the name marzipan, which is understandable. They ought to change the name of the SCoF score as well, really, shouldn't they?
I think there's quite a few acronyms that are food, and it's kind of funny that they're eating disorders.
Well, I think if these things were initially all written by people who had eating disorders, they wouldn't have acronyms like that.
No.
But I guess people who haven't got eating disorders, I just thought, oh, yeah, that would be quite good to do it with food, but, you know, without really thinking of the effect that might have on the people they were trying to help. Yes, so it's changed to MEAD because it's not just a reference to anorexia nervosa, so they've changed it to eating disorders so that it's not all about anorexia. There is guidance in there for bulimia nervosa as well. Not so much for binge eating disorder, for bulimia and anorexia, and they're referenced to others. So that's why the name was changed.
Why is there not so much for binge eating disorder? Is that because people don't come to A&E, or?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's it. Because really, what the whole point of the guideline is to try and prevent death from people who are really ill with mainly anorexia nervosa. Those are the ones that we hear about, and they're all very tragic, and nobody should really die from anorexia on a medical ward. But then obviously bulimia also has some potential to cause people to present to A&E, you know, if they get low potassium or they get esophageal rupture or something like that from their vomiting. But I think that those with binge eating disorder probably don't have so many sort of acute problems that would necessitate admission to hospital. More people have binge eating disorder than the other ones, as I understand it. But it doesn't have so many acute problems that might cause, you know, death within a few days or something like that. And that's really what this is, this guideline's trying to prevent.
So is the guideline sort of like, I know you were saying at the start that you didn't kind of educate healthcare professionals on signs and symptoms, but is it that sort of thing? Is it kind of the signs and symptoms to look out for and then kind of what to do thereafter, or is it a different approach?
Again, to be quite honest with you, I can't remember, but I don't think it's not designed to be a textbook about eating disorders. So if I remember rightly, it doesn't have a lot about the signs and symptoms to look out for to make the diagnosis. It is really designed for non-eating disorder specialists to do proper assessments to assess physical risk for health. But along with that, there's, you know, it's not just that. There's a whole chapter about refeeding and tube feeding, and whole chapters about families, and chapter about what do you call it, consent treatment, sectioning and capacity and all that. You know, it's a really, really comprehensive document. And then there's a whole new chapter about type 1 diabetes and eating disorders, which there wasn't in the Marsplan guidelines. And then there's a whole chapter about where best patients should be treated, and chapter for commissioners. And, you know, it's a very comprehensive document, but it's not a textbook about eating disorders, should we say. It's very specific in its angle, I suppose, the thing to say.
I suppose that sense of kind of being more specific and not so much of a textbook is quite a good referral tool if you're in the moment and you need to use it, rather than having this hefty textbook to kind of have something to refer to. I think, you know, that's kind of the thing you need.
But even this is quite hefty. Even this is quite hefty. So, I have to say, I have to keep making this point and drumming it home that you need something that, you know, if you're working in your emergency department, you have somebody with anorexia who's potentially medically unstable, you've got to decide what to do with them. You've got to have something that you can just quickly go onto Google, find it, print it off and use it. You don't want to have to wade through a whole load of stuff to find the bit that you need. You just haven't got time to do that. That would put people off doing full assessments. So so it needed to be something that was very usable. And I think it is, as long as people know about it and know where to find the information that they need, which I think is probably a lot easier with this, with MEAD, than it was with Marsipan, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right completely. I think that was something that I did in my dissertation as well, was to create a sort of handout to give to the paediatric nurses at the end and say, you know, here's the thing, the main points that we've kind of wanted to highlight for you today, and here's some kind of further referrals or further references to go to, should you need them. But you mentioned, just as you were talking about the guidelines, you mentioned a few things that I'd just like to, I guess, pick up on, just in case, you know, people are wondering what it is, or kind of how it appears. And the first one you mentioned was refeeding syndrome. So I just wondered if you would mind kind of giving a bit of an explanation of how that might show up in someone with an eating disorder.
Okay, I'm no expert, okay, because I'm an emergency doctor and not a medic that's ever fed anyone. But the basic nuts and bolts of it are is that if you have really, really restricted your feeding significantly for more than a couple of weeks, so either having, just having very, very little nutrition in that time, your body goes into kind of starvation mode. If you suddenly are fed, you know, a normal amount of calories, but you're suddenly fed a lot, that can cause a lot of shifts in the electrolytes in your body. So the, the different salts and things moving in and out of cells. And then that can have further problems, cause further problems mm-hmm. then. So when you start refeeding somebody who's had little or no nutrition for some time, you have to do it quite cautiously. However, the sort of old refeed, the main refeeding guidelines, not necessarily to do with eating disorders, are about refeeding people who are severely malnourished for other reasons, not necessarily from eating disorders. But as I understand it, people with anorexia are actually much less likely to get refeeding syndrome than somebody who's, say, really malnourished from Crohn's disease or, you know, something else. Right. So they're very clear in this guideline that, yes, you have to start cautiously, but you have to build it up very quickly. Within a couple of days, they should be on full amount of food.
Right.
Because I think what's happened in the past is that on medical wards, the sort of medical teams not really understanding it have been so worried about refeeding syndrome, they've taken it so cautiously that actually what you have then is underfeeding. So it's very important that people see those guidelines and look at them and think, yeah, well, we'll start at so many calories per kilogram per day, but actually within, you know, 24, 48 hours, we need to be up to full thing because the risk of refeeding syndrome isn't that high for this particular case.
Right. Okay. Well, to say that you said you weren't an expert, that was very helpful. So thank you. And I think, like you say, it's really important for people to be aware of the fact that, you know, yes, it's a potential, but equally, you know, if somebody does come in with an eating disorder, that nutrition needs to go up fast and not to be concerned, you know, doing the right thing, kind of, you know, to follow that guidance is the most important thing, to make sure that they're getting enough nutrients for what they need.
And the other thing is that they're getting it early enough. I mean, I've had cases, you know, that I'd seen in A&E that I referred to the medics, and one of them, you know, they didn't get a dietitian to see her for 2 days. And I know that because she was still in A&E 2 days later. And, you know, they weren't feeding her. And I think it's really, really important for emergency clinicians, whether they're A&E or on medical wards, when they see, you know, low heart rate or derangements in their blood tests or something like that, the treatment for all of those things is food, is nutrition. You know, it's not necessarily giving them glucose through a drip or giving them, I mean, they might need to have potassium through a drip, but, you know, that not giving them drugs to speed up their heart rate, it's food. Food is the thing that's going to reverse all those things that have caused them to come into hospital. So it's really important that food is started as soon as possible after admission, really.
Yeah.
To get the dietitians involved.
Yeah. So. Another thing I wanted to ask you about that you mentioned, because when I did my dissertation again, this was something that the paediatric nurses said they found really difficult to sort of understand or to wrap their heads around, because it seemed like a really horrible thing to do for the patients, is NG tube feeding. And you just kind of said about, you know, food is the only kind of, you know, that's the thing to start with. That's the medicine to start with. So is there sort of a reason why somebody would need to go on to an NG tube? Would it be that you try and start them with food first, or would you, is it sometimes you have to go for the NG tube?
Well, it's always better to try with food first, isn't it? Because that's, you know, that's what you're wanting them to do, is to eat. And I mean, it's a kind of personal view, but I think it probably is backed up by evidence, is that quite often once you start tube feeding, it's really difficult to stop, and the person kind of just gets used to being tube fed, and then it's really, really difficult for them to get rid of that and start eating again. That can be quite a long process, so it's always better to get people eating and drinking if you can. But obviously if there is total refusal, or they just can't do it, they just can't get enough in, you know, then you may need to have NG tube feeding.
Yeah, I can imagine sort of through eating disorder recovery, you know, one of the fears is that sitting down and having a meal. And obviously, you know, at the start, if it's for medical stabilization, you want to do things, you want to get the ball rolling as quick as possible. But yeah, I can imagine kind of bringing somebody off a tube feed would be quite difficult to then get them to start eating solids because of that discomfort as well. I can imagine there's quite a lot of gastrointestinal changes that would happen between the NG tube compared to eating a meal.
And I think, I mean, as I understand it, you know, having it through a tube helps with the guilt of eating, because you're not feeding yourself, somebody else is doing it to you. That's how I understand it. So it might be a relief to be tube fed for some people, just like it can be a relief to be sectioned, because they can tell their eating disorder that they're not choosing to do it. So it, you know, gets rid of some of that awful guilt that they feel, which I think a lot of this disorder is all around guilt, you know, how I understand it. And so, you know, being fed by a tube, while probably not particularly pleasant, can be life-saving and very necessary, really. But I'm guessing that what happens is, because it helps to diminish the guilt that one feels from eating, that it's really, really difficult to go back to eating again, because then you'll get all that guilt back. And, you know, so it's better not to get on a tube feed. And that's, again, why it's so important for the nursing staff or the healthcare assistants even to know how to sit with somebody and support them and really, really help them to get that food in.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
just like
absolutely.
They do on eating disorder units, you know. And without that,
yeah,
if people are ill enough that they need admitting to an acute medical bed, they're going to need a huge amount of support to get them to eat, and they need that right sort of support, don't they?
Yeah.
This is why it's so important for people to understand it.
I guess that leads me on to kind of another question. Sorry to bombard you with putting you on the spot. But I think this is something that's in Mead as well, is, you know, with that support would come supporting somebody with compensatory behaviours. You know, I think that's one thing that may not be fully aware is, you know, someone might sit comfortably and eat their meal, but it's, you know, what they're doing after that's the issue. So do you kind of have any advice, or from Mead, what's the kind of guidance, is there any guidance on supporting compensatory behaviours?
Yeah, well, there is a few paragraphs about compensatory behaviours, and I think it is just around making the you know, the general staff on the ward aware that they should probably be on bed rest, and, you know, they shouldn't be going to the loo straight after or going to the bathroom rather straight after having a feed or having some food, and that they should be checking that food isn't secreted around the place. They should just be aware of these things. But, you know, in particular, I think the pacing and the exercise side of it. And, you know, I think, as I say, I haven't had an eating disorder. My understanding is that, you know, there's probably when somebody is really doing that pacing or micro exercising, they just can't make that choice to stop, and they need someone to tell them to stop. And so the staff should be able to do that, really. You know, they should know that they should do that, and they should do that, because sometimes that's what it needs. Because again, as I understand it, you know, they can't make that decision to stop themselves because they'll feel so guilty for it. Their anorexia or their eating disorders make them feel so guilty for it. But if somebody tells them that they have to stop, then they can kind of tell their eating disorder, well, I have to sit still for the next hour, you know, and it kind of absolves them of some of that guilt. So I think if ward staff were aware of those things, then, you know, hopefully it will help to stop those behaviours.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really important, and it's just, I think that all the little things that can be so supportive for somebody in those early stages of recovery that are really vital to sort of catch those signs. Mm. And then I guess the last part that I just wanted to ask about, I think there's also a section on this in Mead, is almost, and you might have kind of something to say here yourself, but the obviously, you know, having a loved one admitted to a hospital is quite a terrifying thing to do. And if you don't know anything about eating disorders, I can imagine that is even scarier. Mm-hmm. So I guess from Mead, what is there some sort of kind of, you know, advice to parents or carers or loved ones in general in terms of, you know, what the best thing for somebody supporting somebody to do? Because I think it's very different. We've spoken a lot on the podcast about supporting someone when you're at home with them. Actually, if they're in a hospital, supporting them from afar, I can imagine, be quite challenging.
Mm. Well, I think I've got a few things to say about this. I think when it very first happens, when you know, you're a new parent of a new person going in and it's their first admission, and you're just terrified and you don't really know anything about it, you don't know what's happening, you kind of put your child or your loved one in the hands of these professionals, thinking, oh, at least they're in hospital now, they'll be looked after and everybody knows what they're doing, which obviously, of course, isn't always the case. So, you know, it's really important that people do understand it as professionals, because these poor parents are kind of giving you their loved one and assuming that you know what to do. But I don't think it takes that long for parents to start wising up and reading about anorexia, etc. And I think then, you know, the parents kind of are the ones that take over and almost telling the hospital staff what they should be doing. And I think it can all become terrifying for parents, because they, as I say, they quickly get to know a lot about anorexia and other eating disorders. And it's really frightening then every time they go to hospital, because it's really potluck whether you get a doctor or a nurse or, you know, any clinician that actually understands it and is going to take it seriously. So I think Mead is that thing that helps the carers with that. And, you know, I always say to people, just take a copy of the, when it was marzipan, if you need to go to A&E, just take a copy of the marzipan checklist with you, because if the doctor or the nurses know nothing about eating disorders, you can show them this and say, this is what you should be doing, and they might learn something, and, you know, hopefully they'll take that on board and do the correct assessment. So I think MEAD is really important for that reason, and also for referring, you know, for the emergency medicine doctor referring to medics or paediatricians who also might not really understand the gravity of the situation. But in the MEAD guideline, there is a whole section for parents and carers. There's a whole section about confidentiality as well, which gives lots of different scenarios. You know, if you've got an 18-year-old or a 17-year-old and they're on this section or that section and they're refusing or whatever, for the parent to be given information, there's all the scenarios about what you can and can't say and talk to the parents about, which I think is really important, because there's nothing worse, I think, than being a parent with your child in hospital and they say that you're not allowed to know anything. I mean, that's just absolutely awful. It's awful. So this kind of talks a bit about that. And then the other thing that is really, really good about the MEAD guidelines is that in one of the, can't remember if it's an annex or an appendix, can't remember, but there's a whole load of summary sheets at the end. So there's a summary sheet for dietitians, there's a summary sheet for nurses, there's a summary sheet for emergency physicians, you know, all these summary sheets, because it's such a long document that the important thing for the different groups are put on a summary sheet, so you've got something to quickly refer to and it kind of signposts you to the particular part of the guideline that you need. There is a summary sheet for carers. And I personally think that all carers should print that off and just have it available to them, just have it there. Because what that does is it tells you all of the things that might be happening that would suggest that you should be taking them into hospital, really. The things that might suggest that that the person is becoming medically unstable. So that's a really useful sort of checklist for you to think of. If you're thinking, oh, should we be taking her to A&E or not? Not quite sure. It tells you if you should, if any of those particular things are happening. And it also signposts you to, which most of you listening would probably know about anyway, about BEAT and, you know, various organisations. But to a new person, you know, they're not maybe going to know about those organisations. So they're quite good. I mean, the other thing that just occurred to me and hadn't occurred to me before is if, you know, paediatric and medical gastro wards they would normally go to had a load of those printed off. So if somebody goes in with a new diagnosis, they can hand that to the parents even better. So there is a fair bit in there for carers.
I think, like you say, having those resources accessible to give to people is so important, because I think it can feel like a really daunting and scary, you know, nobody wants to have a child have an eating disorder
frozen,
and you know, to not know anything about it would be really, you know, terrifying. So to have those resources, I think, is essential. Thank you so much, Vicky. I have learnt so much from you, and it's been fantastic to kind of get all your experience and all your knowledge. I'm sure people will be really grateful for this information. So thank you.
Good. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.